Today is Monday, November 8th, 2010. I'm Jess Landing.
And I'm Iqbal Ahmed, and this is News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Good evening. It's 5:07, and it's time for a full hour of independent news. In campus news, we'll be bringing you a story on a new partnership between the graduate faculties of law and journalism meant to correct miscarriages of justice. We will also bring you coverage of a talk given on campus today regarding the future of foreign aid in Africa. And in local news, we will bring you coverage of Media Democracy Day, which drew media markers from across the Lower Mainland to discuss the importance of independent media.
And today we will also bring you Megan Turcato's weekly City Hall update, which you can hear every Monday at News 101. And we will hear from Adam Yanush in our weekly arts feature.
All this plus your weekday weather forecast right here at News 101, your source for independent, local, national, and international news.
But first, the headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Andrew Stelzer with these headlines for Free Speech Radio News. After days of protest, a train carrying 120 tons of nuclear waste from a French processing plant arrived in Germany today. Cinnamon Nippard has more.
Tens of thousands of people demonstrated along the train route through France and Germany over the past few days. While many demonstrations were peaceful, when German activists chained themselves to the railway tracks, riot police responded with water cannons and pepper spray. 16 people were arrested and 3,000 were removed from the train tracks. Anti-nuclear groups say that up to 1,000 people have been injured. The German government's recent decision to extend the life of the country's existing 17 nuclear power plants has ignited anti-nuclear sentiment amongst the general public and environmental groups. The nuclear waste must now be loaded onto trucks to reach its final destination at the controversial Gorleben site, a former salt mine which was originally supposed to be a temporary solution. Greenpeace has serious concerns about the suitability and safety of the location, and more clashes between protesters and police are expected. Cinnamon Nippard, FSRN, Germany.
A nuclear power plant in Vermont was shut down Sunday because of a radioactive leak. A spokesman for the company, Vermont Yankee, says there's no risk of danger from the leak. Earlier this year, state legislators rejected a request by the company to keep the plant open for 20 more years. Instead, it will be closed down in 2012. There was also a shutdown at a nuclear power plant outside New York City after a transformer exploded. While half the plant remains up and running, the Entergy Corporation says there's no danger of a radiation leak. Some 20,000 people rallied in Seoul this weekend in advance of the G20 summit coming to South Korea later this week. Riot police doused demonstrators with pepper spray and four protesters were arrested. There was also a demonstration in front of the South Korean embassy in Manila after several Filipino activists said they were denied entry to South Korea and forced to return home. President Obama is one of many world leaders expected to attend the Group of 20 summit in Seoul. Exchange rates will likely be an item high on the agenda. South Korean labor unions have been leading the protests. They say policies promoted by the G20 are bad for workers and favor multinational corporations. Gunmen in speedboats attacked an oil rig off Nigeria's coast today and took five crew members hostage. The incident in Africa's largest oil exporter led to a two-year high point of oil prices. Sam Alakoye reports from Lagos.
Security sources say the kidnapped men are two Americans, two French, and one Canadian. A friend, the oil company which operates the rig, says a support vessel was also attacked and it has suspended drilling on the rig. The incident comes as the main militant group in the oil-producing Niger Delta region, the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta, or MEND, announced it will start attacks on other oil installations in the region in the coming days. MEND, which says it is fighting for local control of oil proceeds, has disrupted Nigeria's oil exports in the past by attacking oil installations and kidnapping foreign oil workers. The group also says it is holding three French nationals and a Thai seized off Nigeria's coast in September. Sam Lukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
At least three people died early today when Moroccan police broke up a protest camp in the largest city of the Western Sahara a day ahead of planned negotiations at the UN about the future of the disputed territory. A representative for the Polisario Front, the group seeking independence, accused the Moroccan government of trying to sabotage the talks. More than 150 protesters were released from jail this weekend. They were arrested in Oakland on Friday after a former transit officer was sentenced to just 2 years for killing an unarmed man. Hundreds of people gathered in downtown Oakland after the officer, Johannes Messerly, was sentenced to 2 years in prison for involuntary manslaughter. Messerly shot and killed the unarmed Oscar Grant on New Year's Day 2009. When Friday's protests turned unruly, police penned more than 100 protesters in a residential area. Ali Nasser was one of many in the streets who compared the white officer's sentence to that of football player Michael Vick.
I think justice wasn't served. If they don't give Michael Vick 4 years for killing dogs, and they don't give that white man 2 years for killing a human being, what they trying to say, a dog is a black man is like worth lesser than a dog? A regular human being will not get 2 years for killing somebody. You'll get time. But I guess he ain't no regular human being. He must be better than us.
Prosecutors have the option of retrying Officer Messerly on a gun charge, which carries a sentence of up to 10 years in prison. There's also a civil suit pending against the Bay Area Rapid Transit Agency. A Texas state legislator slept on a hallway floor for two nights in order to be first in line to file several anti-immigrant bills Monday morning. Representative Debbie Riddle proposed bills that would punish so-called sanctuary cities and would require ID to vote in Texas. She also filed another measure modeled after Arizona's infamous SB 1070 that would have local police check people's immigration status. Similar bills have been introduced and failed in the past, but after last week's election, the state's Republicans now have a larger majority than ever. For Free Speech Radio News from Oakland, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
Thanks to FSRN for bringing us those news headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found on FSRN.org. I'm Iqbal Ahmed.
And I'm Jess Landing. Now it's time for our own News 101 headlines. In campus news, UBC journalism students are partnering with the UBC Law Department in what law professor Tamara Levy calls the first partnership between law students and journalism students in Canada. The Innocence Project, which was founded in 2007, works to investigate miscarriages of justice to prevent the unlawful conviction and imprisonment of accused individuals. Together, the students will investigate and review court transcripts while tracking down unknown witnesses to uncover new evidence. Currently, there are 30 cases, primarily murder or sexual assault convictions, under review. This new partnership for the project will bring three students from UBC's Graduate School of Journalism to work with the 10 law students and 24 supervising lawyers on these cases. Dr. Levy says that the project is excited to have the journalists on board because, quote, they bring unique skills that will help us shed some light on our investigations and move them forward more quickly, end quote.
In regional news, Friday saw many students of UBC's Okanagan campus gather to rally against rising tuition rates and sign petitions to lower tuition fees. The rally included the dropping of pumpkins from a crane by members of the student union, meant to symbolize the dropping of various student fees, as such as parking and athletics. Since 2001, it is estimated that tuition has risen more than 225% from an average of $2,000 per year to approximately $4,500 per year.
In campus news, Imelda Wong, a PhD candidate at UBC's School of Environmental Health, recently published an article in the Scandinavian Journal of Work, Environment and Health, focusing on the correlation between working night shifts and injuries on the job. The study found that Canadians are twice as likely to be injured while working night or rotating shifts than those working regular day shifts. Researchers also claim that females in such positions are more prone to the injuries than their fellow male workers. The culprit? Wong blames sleepiness, stating that those who work night shifts are constantly sleep-deprived and may be more fatigued, thus increasing the risk of injury. As a result, Wong and her researchers conclude that it is imperative for both the government and employers to, quote, consider policies and programs to help reduce the risk of injuries among shift workers, end quote.
In more campus news, today world-renowned economist and New York Times best-selling author Debasi Moyo gave a free talk at UBC's Chan Center regarding the thesis presented in a popular book, Dead Aid. The theory, which debunks the popular foreign aid approach of wealthier countries to Africa and instead moves for a more opening of markets and increasing microfinancing to improve Africa's currently stalled development, stands in direct opposition to the current aid policies of the Western world. Moyo drew upon countries such as Brazil, China, and Rwanda in support of her thesis, and pointed to the fact that over the past 60 years of foreign aid Africa has experienced, growth has actually declined. The talk was sponsored through the coordination between the UBC Terry Project, the Africa Awareness Initiative, the Vancouver Institute, London for Africa, the Commerce Undergraduate Office, and the UBC President's Office, and was presented to a nearly full hall of students, alumni, faculty, and staff. News 101 reporter Claire Eagle attended the talk. Claire, how do you feel about Moyer's points?
I think it was really interesting just to see what she said. Definitely what she said was something that you don't hear too often. I think we live in a society where models such as Jeffrey Sachs's model of more aid, like 0.07% financing, like it's really interesting to see someone who's speaking against aid to Africa and not doing so from a standpoint of, I guess, let's kill the African babies, as she was quoted as saying, because she's been misquoted to say that, but in fact saying that cutting aid and increasing microfinancing, and instead of giving money to the governments, increasing investment and opening up a private sector, and seeing how that would positively affect Africa instead.
How did she feel that? What should foreign governments do to help this come about?
Well, some points she talked about were things like increasing bonds so that foreign companies could buy bonds and encourage investment. Other points, she definitely talked about, I guess, regional cooperation and increased regionalism instead of having, say, four countries with four different currencies where you need four visas to travel in them, which definitely doesn't help trade. Instead, creating more of a regional bloc where they can have maybe a similar trading currency. Also, she did criticize some of the West policies of agricultural subsidies, which then hinder exports from these countries that may have their own agriculture, which is harmful. But at the same time, she did say she understands, of course, an American government is going to prefer to subsidize like farmers in Iowa rather than getting exports from, say, Zambia. And she says she very much feels that they give then a chunk of aid money to these foreign countries almost as trying to remedy the fact that they can't buy these exports.
Mm-hmm. The example she used of Rwanda is very interesting. How did she compare Rwanda to other countries in Africa?
Well, Rwanda is interesting because they did have a large genocide not too long ago in which 1 million people were killed in only 90 days. And she said she very much feels that the West is having a sort of almost guilt feeling towards Rwanda, in which they're trying to give so much aid to remedy the fact that when the genocide happened, they just weren't there. But the Rwandan president has actually stood up and said that he doesn't want any more aid from the West. And Rwanda is currently experiencing 7% growth, largely due to growth in the private sector, which is what is supposed to be the targeted growth rate for all of Africa in order to get Africa out of poverty. So I think Rwanda is just interesting because I think here in the West we often see it as a tragedy in Rwanda because we're still stuck in the mindset of, I guess, the genocide, and I think our general African misconceptions of poverty and, I guess, circle of negativity and so on. But I think Rwanda really is a positive example because there has been a lot more, I guess, entrepreneurship and opening of the private sector there, which has helped them to start climbing out of the circle of poverty?
Well, critics of her standpoint would point to examples such as the Marshall Plan after World War II. Why was Germany and Japan so successful in building their economies and not Africa?
It's definitely not necessarily a question of providing aid, but the length of the aid. I think the Marshall Plan was so successful largely because it had a set amount of time, and after that, the aid was over. It was given, the countries in the Marshall Plan were given a certain amount of money to build their economies, and at which point, I guess five years or so later, they were considered built and the aid stopped. Whereas with Africa at this point, it's become, she used the term, a drug. Basically, there is no strings on this aid. There's no point where it's going to stop coming. It's basically, I think for some countries, the aid now comprises between 70 and 90% of their GDP, which is just ridiculous when you think about it, because that means that their own production in the country is just not happening. They're so dependent on foreign aid, there is no incentive for these countries to have production when they can just apply to the World Bank and get a grant of money.
The common people on the street who obviously give to charities and feel that the West should help Africa will point to things such as corruption within African countries rather than foreign aid as the stem of all these problems. How did she combat these sort of positions?
I think she definitely touched on the fact of corruption, and that was part of her movement for, I guess, more opening up of the private sector to increase investment and microfinancing to help entrepreneurs within the countries grow. And as well, I think she really wants to see Africans taking hold of African economic policy and wants more accountability of African governments to the people. Because at this point, she pointed out, they're not really accountable to the people at all, because in Western countries, governments rely on their populations to elect them and then use the tax base to create services such as education and so on. Whereas in many African countries, with this aid, they're not reliant on their population because they really don't need to tax them at all to get their funds. They can just go to the World Bank and get this money to have development or to have money. So there's really no one they're accountable to. And that is definitely a huge problem, because with this aid, it creates this unaccountability, and it really separates the leaders from their people.
Great. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks for that, Claire. In more campus news, a Harry Potter frenzy has hit campus, with some residences organizing trips to the premiere of the much-anticipated movie and screening the first six installments to amp up students. The anticipation is becoming very apparent. Yet, there is perhaps a better example to showcase such Potterphilia, and that is UBC's newly formed Quidditch Club. As reported by the UBC, the club has been recently approved by the AMS and already has 30 paid members, over 100 fans on Facebook, and is eager to start up matches. With over 200 colleges in the States and three others in Canada already having Quidditch teams, and the fourth Quidditch World Cup being held later this month in New York, the club's possibilities are endless. Interested? There's a sign-up tomorrow at 7 p.m. in the Place Vignier Commons block. But don't forget, as President Verena Facundo says, quote, it's BYOB, bring your own brooms, end quote.
In local news, this past Wednesday, British Columbia Premier Gordon Campbell unexpectedly announced his resignation and called for the BC Liberal Party to hold a leadership conference to pick his replacement. The surprising announcement came amid approval ratings dipping as low as 9% and the rumor of Liberal MLAs planning to call for his resignation in the upcoming caucus. Despite being named Canada's best financial manager by the Fraser Institute in October, his nearly decade-long tenure as the head of BC's Liberals came under much criticism after his introduction of the Harmonized Sales Tax, or HST.
We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Government and Big Pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy in which secret government contracts are sold to Big Pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces, all in a sinister plot to get alien embryos in our coffee so Big Pharma can sell us alien contraceptive pills. Or, if you'd rather get some rational news, check out Radio Free Thinker, the radio show / podcast that promotes skepticism, critical thinking, and science education. Every Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Until now, Canada's internet has been an open network and a level playing field for free speech and innovation. All that is under threat. A handful of companies want to limit what you can access on the internet. In May, SaveOurNet.ca led a successful campaign pushing net neutrality to the top of the Liberal Party website. Now, both the New Democratic Party and the Liberals have official policies supporting net neutrality. In addition to that, the CRTC has recently issued new rules intending to prevent the actions of some internet service providers from limiting certain types of traffic and content on the web. But the battle does not end there. To tell the government that net neutrality is a vital part of our democratic society, and for more information, visit www.saveournet.ca. This message is brought to you by SaveOurNet.ca and CITR 101.9 FM.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots global unembedded international independent news hour. And this is CITR 101.9 FM.
Welcome to News 101. I'm Iqbal Ahmed.
And I'm Jess Landing. You're hearing us on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. Thanks for being with us. The current time is 5:27, and time for your weekday weather forecast. For that, we go to Daniel Casanova.
Thanks, Jess. Well, we got a low-pressure system headed straight for us, bringing rain and wind for tomorrow. The long-term forecast doesn't look so good either, with Wednesday being the only day without a chance of precipitation. And here is your UBC forecast. For tonight, cloudy with a slim chance of showers, low of 5 degrees. For tomorrow, expect rain and wind, ending in the early evening. High of 9 degrees, low of 5. On Wednesday, mix of sun and cloud, high of 9, low of 4. For Thursday, rain with a high of 9, low of 4 degrees again. For Friday, cloudy with a chance of showers, high of 10 degrees, low of 5. On Saturday, 70% chance of showers with a high of 11 degrees, low of 5. And for Sunday, chance of showers with a high of 11 and a low of 6 degrees. Currently, it is 8 degrees and cloudy at YVR. The normal temperatures for this time of year are a maximum of 10 degrees and a low of 3. That's your weather this week, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. For News 101, I'm Daniel Casanova.
Thanks as always to Daniel Casanova and the Storm Club of UBC for bringing us that forecast. We now go to Megan Turcotto's weekly City Hall update, which you will hear every Monday here on News 101.
People up there in City Hall.
City Hall makes a lot of little decisions that affect us all in big ways. This segment asks, what happened at City Hall this week?
And here's your bevy of highlights from this week's City Hall action. The VPD will have their own all-terrain vehicles to do beach patrols starting in 2011. Police have been patrolling West Side beaches during the summer months using rented ATVs. The shore patrol started in 2003, but was dropped 2 years later due to funding and staffing issues. The VPD says the patrols, which were resumed in 2007, helped them be proactive about disorder on public beaches, instead of simply waiting for complaints. The city will provide just under $30,000 for the new vehicles. An interesting side note to this issue is the carbon factor. As part of the Greenest City Initiative, whereby Vancouver tries to become the greenest city in the world by 2020, all civic endeavors are vetted for their environmental friendliness. In the case of the ATVs, a city report concluded that while the vehicles will give off 1.9 metric tons of CO2, the police force's emissions will actually be reduced. According to city rationale, the carbon reduction comes because police won't be driving their higher-emitting patrol cars during the time they spend on all-terrain-powered beach patrol. Laneway houses will continue to go up around Vancouver. The issue was up for debate after a report on the effects of the first 100 backyard apartments. Councillor Anton voted against the motion.
I don't think I'm going to be able to support this motion. I'm very disappointed by the fact that council has offered no immediate reaction whatsoever to the many comments that we heard the other day. Contrary to what I think it was Councillor Louis said about some people didn't like them and some did, I actually heard very few people the other day saying they didn't like laneway housing at all. But many people mentioned problems relating to the height. So the fact that council is going to take no action on that, I think, is extremely disappointing.
Anton did table a motion to restrict the height of these laneway houses to 1.5 stories going forward, but was vastly outvoted by the rest of council. Mayor Robertson explains why he supports the continuation of the building of laneway houses.
The principles involved here are very important in addressing affordable rental housing and keeping families together, but we undoubtedly have room for improvement here. It is a good time for us to make sure we're tweaking this in a way that makes sense for the rest of the city, but I think it's important to keep making progress on this.
Council will hear another report on the progress of laneway houses 6 months after the completion of the 150th home. Mayor Robertson officially recognized Movember, or Mustache November, an event which encourages the growing of mustaches, this month to raise awareness about prostate cancer. Gregor has promised that he himself will, by the end of the month, also be sporting a stash. And this has been your weekly City Hall Update. I'm Megan Turcato.
Thanks to Megan Turcato for bringing us that report.
It's now time for a weekly arts report from Adam Gnoosh, who talked to the director of UBC Players Club production of Flu Season.
Love story set in a mental health institution. And director Brian Cochran is here to tell us what that means. Hello, Brian.
Hello, Adam.
So, a love story set in a mental health institution.
That's correct.
Give us a quick synopsis. What is it?
Okay. Oh, boy. It's hard to sum this play up. It's an absurdist, tragic comedy love story. it is set in a mental institution, and it's also set in the theater. So it's a play about the difficulties of creating something beautiful. So whether that's a relationship or a life or a piece of art, the ways that we try and struggle with that.
Now, does the mental institution have a theater? Or...
No, so there's two narrators who talk directly to the audience who help guide us through the play. And as we go through the play, I think it comes out that the narrators share some common experience with the story itself.
So perhaps there's a twist there that...
There's no, like, big surprise, like... usual suspect style twist or anything. but I think it ultimately makes it quite satisfying because the narrators are trying to give you this story and then the story starts to take on a different tone. So it asks a really important question, which is what do you do when your feelings change? Mm-hmm. So your feelings about something, your feelings for somebody, do you honor that change in feeling even if it's going to totally crush somebody else? Mm. Or do you keep yourself unhappy to not hurt somebody else? And it's pretty interesting.
Cool.
Dilemma.
How long have you been working on this particular show?
We've been working on this show not for too long, a few weeks, but very part-time. So it's through the UBC Players Club, ubcplayersclub.com. And it's like a student club that lets students who want to put on their own play put on a play. So you apply in the spring. Mm-hmm. So back in March or April, I applied with this play. And then they put out a call. So it's we have... three first-year students and a second-year student and a couple of recent UBC grads in the cast. It's a cast of six. We've been at it for about, 3 weeks, but, I mean, it's really been, like, 40 hours of rehearsal. Not too much.
And tell me, what's been the biggest challenge for you as a director in bringing your vision to the stage?
This is a very complex play where the characters behave in very contradictory unpredictable ways, and it's been a real big challenge to motivate all those choices or help the actors find the motivation for these choices, because seemingly they'll be going in one direction and then, like, boom, 360 another direction. And I mean, yes, they're in a mental health institution, but it's not about crazy people or the treatment of people who are mentally ill. It's not about that at all. It's tough. It's tough to find motivation sometimes, but we all do it, right? We all are very contradictory in our lives. So it makes them interesting and real, but it's certainly been a huge challenge to find the motivation.
Why is he doing this right now?
Well, there's one scene where this guy, the man is trying to, and they're called man and woman, and he's trying to flirt with her, and then all of a sudden he just goes into this little, like, thing where he starts talking to the ceiling, It's just stuff like that comes out of nowhere. And like I said, the play is a bit fragmented at times because it's about trying to create. Mm-hmm. So that's been difficult. We've only put it together once, and there is a play in there. And we're dusting it off in our final week of rehearsal.
Nice. And now tell me, What's the flu season connection? It's certainly very timely as
you're recovering from the flu, and we're heading into flu season. It's a love story that starts in the fall. So the story starts in the fall, goes all winter, and ends in the spring.
Oh, so is love like the flu, where you kind of catch it? And then
you know, I wouldn't say that's like a direct. I wouldn't say that's anything we're going for, but yeah, you can certainly infer that from it. I mean, it has to do with. So at the start of the play, it's supposed to be called The Snow Romance, and then the title gets amended to The Flu Season. So it maybe has to do with, the bittersweet nature of how a lot of romances turn out.
Interesting. All right, and this will be playing at the Dorothy Somerset Studios, which is on campus.
On campus. It's on University Boulevard between Main Mall and West Mall. Mm-hmm. It's a big green barn with signs in the windows that say there's a theater in here. It's November 10th to the 13th at 8 p.m. Tickets at the door, or you can go to ubcplayersclub.com and find out how to reserve some tickets. And there's also a Saturday matinee at 2 o'clock on the 13th, and I should stipulate on top of all that the November 10th performance is Pay What You Can.
So for all the poor struggling artists,
Struggling students, struggling student artists, I encourage you to come and not pay anything if you can't afford it, but you want to come see it. I mean, I'd rather come to that Wednesday show. It's our first audience, so we thought we'd make it Pay What You Can.
Great.
Yeah.
Thanks, Brian, for telling us about it.
Cheers, man.
Thanks for that, Adam. We now go to News 101's coverage of Media Democracy Day this past weekend, which was broadcasted live on Saturday from the Vancouver Public Library by our News 101 team. Here is an excerpt from the first panel we heard, titled Fox News or Democratic Communication, Media at a Crossroads. The panel discussed our national media policy framework and unspoken biases of regulation and power in our media culture, and featured Tony Berman, senior executive of the Americas for Al Jazeera English, as well as SFU communication professor Donald Gutstein and David Skinner, chair of the Department of Communication Studies at York University.
Dylan and Steve, the Andersons, for introducing the panel. Tony, in his excellent address, said that the media system is broken. Well, I agree that the media system is broken for us, but it's working just fine for them. Right, it's working the way they want it. And my unpleasant job today is to sketch out how it's working for them, the right-wing media infrastructure, what it is, how it works, and why they're doing what they're doing. The panel got its name from the Fox News North, the meeting that Stephen Harper had with Rupert Murdoch in New York in March of 2009, and from that meeting, when it was made public, came the Fox News North story, and somehow that meeting had something to do with it. But I don't think it did. Like, why would Rupert Murdoch, one of the most important global media barons, be meeting to discuss what some minor tycoon from Quebec could set up a Fox News North knockoff? Like, didn't make sense. There's something more going on there. Because Rupert Murdoch only meets with national leaders in countries where he already has media properties. Like, he'll meet with Barack Obama in the US, or with David Cameron in the UK. And sometimes he meets with leaders, like in the early 90s, when he wanted to get his Star satellite TV system approved by the Chinese government. So he courted them for a few years before they gave him approval for this. So Murdoch does not have any media properties in Canada yet. So I think there's a bigger story going on than just this Fox News North one. When it becomes public in the fullness of time, because Murdoch waits till the time is right, it's not going to be pretty, I believe. Okay, a second comment that I want to make in terms of relating to the right-wing media infrastructure, we need to look not only at the media properties and their owners, but we also have to look at the sources of news that are given preference, privileged in the system. And that's why I need to bring up the broader context of the global neoliberal movement. In my view, they are an integral part of the infrastructure. And what this is about is to capture political power and to transform society into an inegalitarian market state. Some places like Chile, where they could just seize power directly, but in democratic countries, they have to do this by changing the climate of ideas. And how you change the climate of ideas is to reach what Friedrich Hayek, the father of neoliberalism, called the secondhand dealers in ideas. And these are the media, but they're also teachers, ministers, novelists, a whole range of people who do not create the ideas themselves, but they distribute them to their audiences. And so what we need to look at is a very long-term project by the neoliberal movement worldwide to influence through the media to change the climate of ideas. That's important to keep in mind. Without getting into too much detail, one example would be like setting up a think tank like the Fraser Institute, whose role is to package neoliberal doctrine in what they call research, and then deliver it to their audiences. And an example of that would be the doctrine in terms of education is government schools are awful. Like, they don't use the term public schools, they're government schools are awful and they need to be eliminated and replaced by privately owned schools. So that is the doctrine that was enunciated by Milton Friedman. And then, so the Fraser Institute's role is to take the doctrine, create these school report cards, which look like research, and then disseminate them to the media. Okay, and by doing it year after year after year, finally, those ideas become accepted. It's good to rank schools. What's wrong with a little competition in schools? So we have on one side all the sources that are pushing the agenda. At the same time, the owners of media have been moving to meet them. We know that commercial media, capitalist media, have always been supportive of capitalism and hostile to government, unions, and social movements. But starting in the mid-90s, this all was accelerated when Conrad Black took over control of the Southam papers. What he did was, first of all, to fire and replace liberal editors, to cut newsroom staffs, which made it more difficult for them to go out and get a variety of viewpoints on a story. If you have fewer people, you have to do more stories. You only go to the official and government sources. And besides, like, if I know the guy in the next desk has been fired, I got to keep my head down and do what the boss wants. He brought in conservative columnists that are still populating all of the CanWest papers. He raided the Fraser Institute for staff. He created the National Post, a staunchly dedicated conservative paper. And all of that together helped create the Canadian Alliance, the Conservative Party under Stephen Harper, and so on. That pattern has existed over two owners since Black sold the papers to the Aspers in 2001. Now we have Paul Godfrey running the papers, and he's the head of a company called Post Media Network, okay, which is a company that now owns all of the major papers in Canada. But Godfrey doesn't own the papers. They are now owned, as far as I can tell, by a group of American hedge funds led by a company called Golden Tree Asset Management. So for some, you know, the Competition Bureau, they all let it through. And so Golden Tree Asset Management. and our daily newspapers that we rely on for the information we need in a democracy. The owners see this as an asset to be managed. And what do hedge funds do? They're run by very wealthy individuals who are prepared to take higher risks in return for higher returns. So they're not in it for the long term, they're in it for the short term to get as much profit as they can and then flip it somewhere else. So the first component in the right-wing media infrastructure is most newspapers in Canada. The Post Media papers, all of the Sun papers, the Sun TV that was mentioned before. Pierre-Carl Péladeau, who owns the Sun newspaper chain and was a promoter of this Fox News North, all of those papers, which doesn't include the Vancouver Sun, but the Toronto Sun and a whole bunch of those, they're also, if you ever look at them, very conservative in their approach as well. They have columnists like Ezra Levant, Peter Worthington, Michael Corrin, and their ilk. Last night, David Beers, when he talked about the Globe and Mail and how Conrad Black and Izzy Asper were communicating about combining the Globe and Mail and the National Post into one national daily, he said that didn't happen, but it actually did. And how it happened is because if you look at the editorial board of the Globe and Mail, two-thirds of them are people from the National Post. And the comment editor at the Globe and Mail is from the National Post, so it's happened. And so what I got to say is, like, as the main part of this right-wing media infrastructure are the daily newspapers in Canada. That's the most important thing. I'll talk briefly about some of the other components. Talk radio is owned by the right. Yes, and the main actor there is the Chorus Radio Network. Now here in Vancouver, we have Bill Good and Christy Clark, who we would call centrists. But if you look at the overall network, I mean, they are overwhelmed by the Charles Adlers, Roy Greens, and there's a half a dozen others. So that's a big part of the infrastructure as well. Chorus is most prominent, but there are several smaller networks, like one I found, the Golden West Radio Network, which broadcasts to rural Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta, beaming a mix of Christian and right-wing programming that we would never come across. One of the neoliberal think tanks, the Frontier Center for Public Policy in Winnipeg, has a deal with Golden West to distribute its libertarian commentaries across the network. Third component, the internet. On the internet, the blogging Tories prevail. There's over 100 bloggers who relentlessly promote Harper, libertarianism, and conservatism, and attack government and progressive values. Now, certainly there's a lot of stuff on the internet. I'm not saying they own the internet, but they've got a momentum, and their members will write an op-ed piece in the National Post. Somebody else will pick, one of the bloggers picks it up. Hey, did you see what was in the Post today? And it goes around and around the blogosphere, splashes back into the media, and these ideas sort of rise into public consciousness. We have no idea where they came from. Okay, so all of that's happening. A fourth component is Maclean's magazine, which entered the right-wing infrastructure in 2005 when billionaire, I forgot to mention all the billionaires that run these organizations, billionaire Ted Rogers brought Ken White from the National Post to run Maclean's, and White brought a bunch of his National Post cronies in with him. And I won't say that the Maclean's is as bad as something like the National Review in the U.S., but it's tending in that kind of a direction. And while I'm talking about Maclean's, I want to just mention Andrew Coyne, who I would say is the godfather of the right-wing media infrastructure. He's, of course, a national editor for Maclean's. He's seen quite frequently on CBC, and we're not going to get into the CBC, although there's the right-wing infrastructure influences everything that's not part of it and drags them all in a certain direction. But Ken White is also an advisor to the, Andrew Coyne is also an advisor to the Preston Manning's Center for Democracy, which trains right-wingers to take over government. And he's also a trustee of Peter Monk's Oria Foundation, which gets its money from Barrick Gold and pumps millions of dollars every year into right-wing think tanks like the Fraser Institute and the Canadian Constitution Foundation. So you can see how all of this fits together as a little pattern. The only hole in the infrastructure is television, and the Fox News North was intended to fill that hole. It's going to happen. It won't be as grandiose as was originally hoped by them. But I want to say that what the billionaire Shaw family do now that they own CanWest, the television stations, will have far more impact, I believe, on most Canadians than a small news channel would have. So I want to finally end with the most important component in the infrastructure, the Harper government. Okay? And I have three quotes that I want to bring to your attention. In 1998, when Harper was head of the National Citizens Coalition and Jean Chrétien was the prime minister, Harper and his fellow neoliberal, Tom Flanagan, wrote this: "The purpose of the conservative movement is to change public opinion and public policy, not solely to elect a party to office with a particular name. Much has already been achieved and can be advanced further by working on public policy and pressuring the governing Liberal Party." So that was in 1998. 11 years later, Harper was now the prime minister, and Flanagan revised the mission of the conservative movement. What he wrote was, "Winning elections and controlling the government as often as possible is the most effective way of shifting public philosophy. If you control the government, you choose judges, you appoint the senior civil service, you fund or defund advocacy groups, and you do many other things that gradually influence the climate of opinion." And I've got to say that if you follow carefully what Harper's been doing, you can see step after step after step. And as to how this all works, I'm going to end with this a quote from Harper's international trade minister, Peter Van Loan. About 2 months ago, the Fraser Institute issued its annual Economic Freedom of the World Index. And this is an excellent propaganda device because you do it every year, so year after year, it becomes part of our landscape of ideas. And because you give rankings, 10.0 or 9.3, people are generally cowed by statistics. So they say, oh yeah, well, it must mean something. So of course, Hong Kong and Singapore are the two leading, most economically free countries, but they're not countries that spring to top of mind when you think of democratic values. So they released the annual rankings. Peter Van Loan was the keynote speaker there. And he ended his remarks by saying this to the Fraser Institute crowd. He said, "So let's work together to continue convincing Canadians of the importance of economic freedom." And I found that quite astonishing that, you know, I found this quote on the government website, so it wasn't secret or anything like that. So Harper and the Fraser Institute and the right-wing media infrastructure are all aligned, as we speak, to further undermine democratic values. And I just want to end by saying it's not a pretty picture, but we need to know the enemy before we can make progress. Thank you.
And that's our program for November 8th, 2010. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, give us a hot news tip, please contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334. Or you can email news@citr.ca. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter with the username CITRNews. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at CITR.ca. For more news, join us Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Iqbal Ahmed.
And I'm Jess Landing.
Today's show was produced by Claire Eagle and Andrew Longhurst. From the entire news team at CITR, thanks for listening. Philip from Career Fast Track is sick, so stay tuned for Sword Throw Clapping Hands. Sword Throw Clapping Hands at 6:30, right here at CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
AMS Bike Co-op for a night of bicycle film fun on Monday, November 8th at 7:30 p.m. at the